Welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast by National Museums NI. Today, we're in conversation with Kenneth McConkie, art historian and widely recognised expert on Belfast-born painter Sir John Lavery. Senior curator of art Anne Stewart sat down with Kenneth to explore the fascinating story of Lavery's life, art and his place in art history.
Well, Kenneth, it's really been a long time coming. I'm so excited that you're finally here and you're in Lavery on location at the Ulster Museum. We're the second venue in this three-venue exhibition. But in a sense, being in Belfast and being in the Ulster Museum is, for us, really the most important moment for this exhibition. And, you know, throughout your career, you have linked back to Belfast and to Lavery. And I'm just going to read one of your quotes. This was from a Belfast Telegraph columnist, Frank Frankfurt Moore, who was writing in 1923-4 that Sir John Lavery easily takes a place among the greatest painters of the day. And, you know, in a sense, for 20 years since Hugh Lane's Guildhall art exhibition in London, Lavery's presence and importance in Ulster, people were becoming more aware of it, and his wonderful Lady in Black, Mrs. Trevor, which is at the entrance to this exhibition, entered the collection here in 1913. And so by the time Moore was writing, and this was 2 years after partition, Belfast had really begun to own Lavery, and he reciprocated in 1929 with the gift of 34 paintings, which he chose so carefully to represent every period of his career as a gift for the Ulster Museum. Mm-hmm. So you were born in Belfast and you are the guest curator of the exhibition. So I wanted to ask you, what is so special about Lavery that has kept your interest for over 40 years?
Well, yes. I suppose really, my origin has to be what was Belfast Art Gallery and Museum originally, before it became the Ulster Museum in the early 1960s. Because, as you say, I was born in Belfast and I grew up here and was brought here as a child. And seeing pictures by Lavery in the top floor of the museum building was important, a starting point for me. But, you know, as happens, you move around and, you know, your career is not in Northern Ireland, but elsewhere. And you are studying artists of the Lavery period. I kind of, you know, inscribed a large circle around Lavery, really, in the early phases when I was, you know, looking at French art and British art. But in that sort of period where artists in Britain and Ireland were traveling to France to learn to paint, and that became a very important pilgrimage, really. Mm. During the 1870s and 80s. And so I did shows of Henri Lartang and George Clausen and other artists of Lavery's contemporary generation. And then, as you well know, Anne, back in 1984, the late Ted Hickey twisted my arm
glad he did.
to come back to Belfast for a big Lavery touring exhibition. And since then, Lavery has probably been a kind of leitmotif that has gone through, really. Obviously I've published a fair bit on Lavery, but he is part of a whole new approach to painting that comes into British and Irish art in the 1880s and 90s. I mean, people are very familiar with the Pre-Raphaelites, and they're very familiar with the sort of early 20th century Picasso generation. But they don't see, or they certainly saw much less in when I was starting to do research and publish, much less of the painters in between.
Yeah. Yes.
Some of whom, like Lavery, did very wonderful works, and which very often were denigrated or consigned to basements in public galleries and seldom seen. So there was a great deal of archaeology, really, that had to go on in the 1980s and 90s to bring this generation out into public gaze.
Yes, because in a sense, that exhibition in 1984, which was where we met, mm-hmm. and that was the mm-hmm. first time I had really looked at Lavery. I'd known Lavery from Dublin, from the studio, mm-hmm. and but not in any great detail. Mm. And also, I was coming to work here at a time after, I suppose, 70s minimalism, when the collection here was very focused on the work of the 60s and 70s.
Yes,
and
indeed.
And in a sense, it was about really breaking open the whole idea of an art gallery and what could be shown in an art
Absolutely.
Gallery.
Absolutely, and wonderful things.
And wonderful things, but a period of tremendous experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the flip side of that was disregard for the period.
Yes,
you've
indeed.
Just described.
I think that is true. It was a process that had been going on even before, you know, American cool school painting that Anne Cruikshank brought
absolutely.
Here in the 60s.
Yeah, and even 50s.
Yes, started. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. It had been going on for quite a number of years. I went through the art schools in the late 1960s. And, you know, hard edge painting was what you had to do if you wanted to be a modern artist. I didn't want to do that. I ended up as an art historian for my sins. Mm. But yes, I did feel sort of very strongly that there was great merit in the painting of around the turn of the 20th century, at the moment when what we call modernism is sort of really born, and when the concept of art as a means of reporting on the world that you see around you, not going back to the pre-Raphaelites and going back into literary subject matter and myths and legends and so on, not like the great Victorians, but actually moving out into the street and saying, if your art wants to be real, it has to be where people are and where real life is going on.
Yeah.
So, and Lavery was very much part of that.
Yeah.
Those were his ethics almost.
Yeah. But it was a remarkable moment, that 1984 exhibition, because in a sense, it was one of the first exhibitions we'd had here for a while where paintings had frames, because for quite a long time,
yes,
we were
indeed.
Doing work that,
Absolutely.
That certainly...
I tell you, look, frames were anathema when I was an art student. You
frames?
Know, I remember... frames, you don't do that. Signing your paintings, you don't do that, for God's sake.
No.
You know, you make a box stretcher, and we were all taught how to do that. Lay your masking tape, for God's sake.
But for our audiences and for people visiting that exhibition, I think there was a real sense of discovery that museums were not just about the modern and contemporary, but they were about the historic. And because also what was interesting at that time was Lavery suddenly was becoming an old master.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was mm-hmm. entering that mm-hmm. new phase.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so a lot of things sort of coalesced at that
Yes,
point.
Indeed. Well, he was looking back to the old masters, as we know from the Père et Fils.
Yeah.
Certainly, that's... very evident in many of the portraits that you see. But he's also dealing with, you know, la moderne, as it were.
Yes.
And when you look across the wall, for instance, behind you to Hazel with her palette and her brushes and, you know, painted at Tangier under a white sketching umbrella and a fashionable hat, you realize that, you know, there is something in modern life that has a validity and must be represented.
Yeah, and it becomes the main thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, very much so, yeah.
So it's 1884. We have a young painter coming back from France to Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
Where does he go? What does he do?
Well, interesting. He finds, when he comes back to Glasgow, that there's a group of young artists who are very much in line with his own thinking.
Mm-hmm.
One or two of them had been to France alongside him, but there were others there who were sort of fascinated by Bastien Lepage and naturalism and so on, very much the talk of the moment, as it were. And Lavery realizes instinctively that, you know, Glasgow is a very kind of go-ahead place. It's picking itself up from years of depression. Its industry is expanding. There is a very cultivated group of collectors who are very keen to buy works that have a sort of European context, rather than the more conservative sort of traditional Royal Academy collector in London. And it seems for a time, certainly for the next 10 years, that Glasgow is going to be really his base. He realizes quite early on two things. One is that the city, in order to demonstrate this kind of sort of go-ahead atmosphere, is planning an international exhibition in the park at Kelvin Grove, and that leads him to set himself up as an artist in residence, really. And we have a lovely wall of some of the pictures that he painted in Kelvin Grove at that exhibition. While he's there, of course, he comes to the attention of the city authorities, and when Queen Victoria comes, on a state visit to look at the exhibition, Lavery is commissioned to paint the reception for her, and that becomes a major task from 1888 to 1890. This is almost the kind of bedrock, in a way, of his career, because once you've done something like that, and once it has been manifestly successful in public terms, and Queen Victoria has approved, you are on your way, really.
Although, in some ways, a sort of commission, a nightmare commission.
Oh, totally, totally. 250 people, all of whom had to be recognisable.
And how many? How long did he have to actually witness it?
Oh, about, 20 minutes or so. No, it's a study in itself. Obviously, there were photographs and so on, and Lavery, we should say, of course, had worked as an apprentice photographer at one stage while he was attending the Glasgow School of Art in the 1870s, so he knew about how to use photographs. But he also realized the colossal limitations of photography. And therefore, the question, the issue was getting the 254 attendees at this event to file through his studio over a two-year period, and then go down to Windsor and get the Queen to pose and all of that. Colossal organizational
energy.
Feat. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. It must have been totally exhausting. Can't think of a worse thing to be lumbered with. But he did it, and he was very successful. Then throughout the 1890s, he's kind of making his first trip to Tangier. He's kind of realizing that there is another world beyond the west of Scotland. And while, some of his contemporaries would always remain rooted in Scotland, he's looking for other ideas and other options elsewhere. So you see him kind of expanding out and eventually migrating to London. And once he buys 5 Cromwell Place, that's his base for the rest of his days.
Tangier is almost the heart of this exhibition.
I think it is a major source for him of motifs. Absolutely. From the moment he arrived.
So, in a sense, I suppose I wanted to ask you in what sense he is an Orientalist, because he's coming at he's a later generation.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think Orientalism, the concept, is very contested these days, totally. Partly because it involves, representation of native peoples and indeed in the Muslim world, subjects that were specifically forbidden,
yes.
like harem scenes and so on.
Yes.
And Lowry's Inheritance as an Orientalist painting was all about semi-salacious views of Oriental harems for Western eyes.
Yes.
Lowry doesn't do that. He paints one harem picture, which he quite deliberately sets out to demystify the whole kind of tradition of Oriental painting. So in a sense, he goes as a reporter. He goes there to say, this is what it is like. This is what I see in front of me. This is the world as it appears to me. And when you find him in the marketplace, yes, he's painting the snake charmers, but they're not the snake charmers that you would find an Orientalist painting.
You hardly see the snakes.
Yes, I know, absolutely. Yeah. They're bypassed.
Yes.
It's part of
a bit
normal
dusty,
way of life. Yes, exactly.
Not
very interesting indeed. I think he is trying to find something different, really, in his trips to Tangier. And I think the thing that he discovers at the end of it, more than anything else, is those magical views of the Straits of Gibraltar that you see, which I think are totally wonderful. And it's that sense of an artist, some people might think, this is a kind of, because he's interested in contemporary society, this is a socialite, and it's all really rather trivial.
Yeah.
And these are the fashions of the day, and they're gone now, and that's it, it's dated. But when he looks out at the sea, society falls away, and you get a painter who is really looking for color, looking for space, how you represent that kind of flat plain that stretches to a horizon. And we have some wonderful examples of that in the show.
The sea is the other great presence.
It is, absolutely, absolutely, yes.
And it's so interesting when he goes to Venice, it's the lagoon.
Yes, indeed, absolutely.
The
or the Lido looking
the
out
Lido.
On the grey waters of the Adriatic,
yeah,
those kind of Istrian stretches of sea, which are very beautiful. Yes, indeed.
And so, again, that's unexpected. But it's also, I suppose, because he really spends a lot of time in Tangier, he's aware of the possibilities of the sea. He's not coming for a month to just paint the subject you expect him to paint. He's absorbing the whole spirit of the place, and the place is as much the light and the sea as it is.
Absolutely. It's very significant. You mentioned Venice. It's very significant when he went there first in 1892. Yes, he painted a small painting of St. Mark's Square, but it's the only one.
Everyone has to.
Yes, I know. But you know, but you think of those artists who painted it day in, day out,
For years.
Because,
Sickert did so many.
Yes, indeed. And Santa Maria della Salute. The gondolieri who took painters around knew the spots and said this is where so and so painted, so you must do this one.
Well, he didn't.
He stayed out at the Lido, and was probably healthier place to stay.
But he's painting the water. That's what is memorable for me about
absolutely.
In a sense, this is so much about place and space and light that there's very little portraiture, which is how we think of Lowry as the consummate portraitist. So it's maybe something to say about, in a sense, how portraiture his skills of observation have infused other scenes.
Yes. Absolutely.
I put that very awkwardly. But
no, but I think portraits are his career as a portrait painter is important, and to some extent, particularly London critics, for instance, regarded him as just that. Mm. Partly because if you did a portrait of an important individual, you know, you got known for that.
Yeah.
You know, people were queuing up to paint Sarah Bernhardt, for instance.
A long queue.
A long queue, you know. So yes, he was doing portraits, obviously, in order to earn money, and also he thought a great deal about portrait painting. You could not spend your time wandering around the Prado or going to Harlem and looking at Hals or, you know, Amsterdam or whatever, and not have imbibed that wonderful golden age of portrait painting. And you do see that in some of his portraits. Indeed, you know, for the two pictures that you have of Hazel and Mrs. Trevor that hang in the Irish Gallery just beyond us are perfect examples of that kind of thing. So they are not to be dismissed, and they are not kind of superficial, you know, this is what I do to make money. Mm. There is more to them than that. But by the same token, you know, he realized that the other side of life, of travel, of seeing new things, of painting scenes in the streets or painting processions and whatever that happened in London, you know, for the armistice, military parades and stuff, that these things were really important, not only because they touched ordinary people, and you know, he always related to a much wider audience, but also because they brought you to what he called concert pitch.
Yeah.
You know, that you test yourself on these things. You are kind of looking at it and trying to translate those colored pastes on the palette into what is there in front of your eye, and that process of, you know, going to Tangier and doing all of that, doing seascapes and views of the town and so on, brought him back to London, as he said, at concert pitch.
Yeah.
You know, he knew exactly when he got into that studio, the eye and brain were fresh.
Yeah.
Whereas other, like, you know, I could name them, but I won't, but, you know, other contemporary portrait painters who only painted portraits become extremely stale and routine, and you really are face painters more than anything else. Lavery was never that.
No. And that's, in a sense, there's always that sort of spontaneity and spirit that you find in almost all his portraits, that you're with him.
Yes.
You're feeling something that he's observing, which is not by any means to be found everywhere.
No, exactly. No, I think he's a great painter, and I think Belfast should be blooming proud of him.
Absolutely. Which I suppose, you know, brings us back in some ways to that 1984 exhibition, which I think was a huge revelation for everyone, because he had been well known in the collection, but really he'd become almost invisible in that generation.
Yes.
And there was a sense of almost reawakening his spirit.
Yes.
And then bringing so many paintings together for that exhibition, because there's a lot of
bones. Oh, 114 works in that show. And, bigger show than this.
And also, you know, even in terms of the scale, the great Anna Pavlova.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't sort of say, well, that's a bit large to travel. I mean, at that moment, everything travels.
All was possible.
And large crates, which we hadn't had for years.
I know.
So it was a...
I thought the guys in the basement did a wonderful job. And can you imagine all of that lot coming?
Oh. Some of the loans were saying, you want to borrow that? We haven't had that out for a long time.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
And it was a moment of it coming up for air.
Totally.
One of the most interesting paintings for me in the exhibition is possibly St. Patrick's Purgatory.
Yes.
Because we talked a little about it in the gallery, and you reminded me of that wonderful story of Seamus Heaney seeing it in the 84 exhibition.
Yes, yes.
And it, you know, in a sense, the whole idea of Lavery in Ireland, it's not something that we are really dealing in any great depth with in this exhibition, but yet it's always in the later part of his career. It's a presence.
Yes, it is. I think Ireland really does kind of need almost, you know, a little study in itself. Mm. Yeah. Partly because Lavery never neglected it. Mm. We mentioned about, you know, the west of Scotland and the collectors in the west of Scotland. But the fact is that in Paisley, for instance, where he was living at one stage, they were intermarried with Ulster Scots. Mm. And one of those collectors was Hugh Smiley, the Smiley family from Larne, from Drumallis. And he was invited to Larne in 1887, before the Kelvin Grove International Exhibition, to paint the Smileys at Drumallis, and he arranged all sorts of things for them. It's an interesting story. What has survived is two very precious small pictures painted at Larne in 1887. And of course, at that time, you know, his uncle was still alive at the farm at Moira and so on, and he was trying to persuade the Glasgow boys, particularly James Guthrie, to come to Ulster to paint. He came back to Drumallis in 1889, and the Smileys, Smiley was married into one of the cotton families in Paisley, his wife, and but he was also one of the owners of the Northern Whig newspaper of hallowed memory. So the connections were very strong across the sort of Larne Stranraer line, really. And in the 1890s, when some of his own generation started to show at the Royal Hibernian Academy, I mean, he began to exhibit regularly in Dublin. And then, of course, you have that wonderful Hugh Lane moment in 1904, when the Guildhall exhibition of Irish art was staged in London, with Lavery showing over a dozen paintings. And by that stage, you see, people hadn't realized that he was actually from this part of the world and not a Scot.
Yes.
So it was an important moment, really. And it's a moment when he begins to realize that, you know, his origins are important. He's writing to his cousins at Moira, the Clenahans. And their letters, in fact, survive and are a wonderful resource. And he starts going back to Ireland on a regular basis. Now, the story, you might think begins with Hazel, but in fact, the roots of it are all there well before Hazel comes on the scene. Obviously, he meets her and courts her for 5 years before the marriage in 1909, in July 1909. And then she becomes very much part of his world, and you see her cropping up in several of the Tangier scenes, on the cliffs, for instance, which is in this room, as well as the big full-length portrait of her at the easel. So, you know, she becomes an important presence, and increasingly she is identifying herself with Ireland throughout the years up to the beginning of the Great War. And she is aware of sort of what he called Celtic Ireland.
Yes.
You know, he, as he was indeed, both were aware of the fact that, you know, there was a kind of cultural revival going on in Dublin with Yeats and Synge and so on, and George Moore, all of those characters, you know, he was aware of. Even the dreadful Bernard Shaw, you know, he was aware of. So those were important. In fact, I should have mentioned, of course, earlier, that because we have it in the exhibition. Mm. I mean, one of the most beautiful portraits that he ever painted is in the show, and yes. It's an Irish girl, yes. You know, who was his first wife. I mean, he later, it happens, discovered that she wasn't actually Irish, but that didn't matter. Mm. When he married her, and when they courted, and before her death, 6 months rather, mm. after Eileen's birth, she was to him an Irish girl. Yeah. So, you know, the sense of Irish identity is really important with him. Yes, of course, when Hazel comes along, it increases. As it increases in Ireland itself, yes. with the Easter Rising and all the events that followed thereafter. Identification with Belfast, of course, and we shouldn't forget the fact that down there in St. Patrick's, yes. is the Madonna of the Lakes.
It is, you know, and so almost the sort of counterpart to Mary Ora.
So yes, indeed, absolutely. Yeah,
lovely,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Connection.
An attempt to make something that is sort of almost classically Irish, if I can use the word classic. Yes. In that sense, yes, indeed.
And he really
so.
Pulls it off.
Yes, you know, yes.
It doesn't have that laboured sense.
No, absolutely. To... It's not a Pre-Raphaelite picture by any means, but you know, rather wonderful thing. So yes, you know, Irish identity is crucially significant, and Irish politics, obviously, mm. you know, and you know, your political portraits, the political portraits down in Dublin, mm. are all actually important. These are all actors in the drama.
They are, and we don't have them on display all the time. Sadly, we just don't have enough space to have them all on display all the time. But when they are put together, all the political portraits, there is an astonishing sense of being there in the room with these people do not get from photographs.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was also interesting when Barbara Dawson at the Hugh Lane Gallery did the 2016 exhibition.
Yes, indeed. No, I saw that.
So we brought the Belfast portraits together with then the treaty portraits in the Hugh Lane. And for me, I'd never seen them obviously together before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And ours are so carefully painted, and he obviously spent so much time
and
presence. Yeah. You know, they're almost old masters.
Yes.
Because there was time, whereas the treaty portraits are so
quickly done.
And there was an amazing sense of just the momentum of history.
Yes,
moving
indeed.
At different
moving,
speeds.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a very, very interesting observation. But I tell you, the one picture which I think is of that whole group that is outstanding is Cardinal Logue.
Well, it is. We have the star.
Yes, indeed. Cardinal Logue is just superb. I mean, it's pure Velasco.
It is, yeah.
It's a real old master. I think really, you know, the crucial point comes around 1916 when he's doing the Madonna of the Lakes.
Yeah.
And the you know, the attempt to make Hazel into what she later becomes, a kind of Kathleen Houlihan for the Irish currency.
Yeah.
So the Madonna of the Lakes is really important in that sense. And I think that's an identity that she takes on, really, in the 1920s. And of course, you know, her involvement with Irish politics and Michael Collins et al. is very well covered. Although there are sort of new things that one, you know, keep coming up and that, you know, need to be said about it. But she does obviously in the 1920s very much become his muse.
Yes.
And you know, the lovely full-length green coat that you have here is a fine example of the sort of picture that he was doing at that time. But she she was a force of nature in herself. They both were, and I can imagine them being kind of lions of the social scene in London in the 1920s. But as I always want to stress, that is not the only thing to say about Lavery. And I think his interest in having people around him was always to do with what they look like, how they appear, reading the mind's construction in the face, and all of that. All of those kind of instincts of a portrait painter.
He was much more a painter than he almost allowed himself to be in his persona, his public
persona. Yes, indeed.
Yes,
absolutely. I think there is a public face. And I think there has to be, and I think in a way, it happens with all of us. We turn ourselves into different things depending on the situation in which we find ourselves. And Lavery, at one sense, if you are a portrait painter, you do have to be all things to all men. But it's those moments, and I think that's why this exhibition is so significant. It's those moments when you turn away from that. And when you paint a bull in the bull ring, or you paint a man on a horse who's, cantering along in front of you, or you paint a clump of palm trees. I mean, those are moments that are really important. And in a way also, some of the scenes become sort of almost emblematic. They become inscribed in the memory almost, so you do find yourself wanting to look back or repeat and so on. Memory and painting, I think, is really very, very significant. It's significant in the moment of creation, obviously, because you do have to think of this artist who is seeing, let's say it's a portrait, seeing that person out there, over there, 12 feet away, regulation, and then kind of taking in bits of it to recreate on a palette in color, and then walk forward to paint it. Memory is something, there are these wonderful stories of Whistler, for instance, walking up to his and forgetting where it was he was going to put the brush, dropping the brush and having to go back and do it all again, look at it again. And Lavery learned so much from artists like that. So memory is part of it, and building up a picture is a kind of an accumulation of moments like that when you're taking something in. And then, as I say, there's the long durée, the Bergsonian concept of memory, which is, as I say, inscribed back there, that draws you back years after the event.